Hey, this is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube, helping you jumpstart your career in financial services. As always, I'm bringing to you fresh ideas from a recently aired video on my YouTube channel, which you can find at www.youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP. Do me a favor, my friend, and text me at 214-699-7599 with any questions you might have from this show so I can help you along your journey in becoming a successful financial professional. Again, that number is 214-699-7599. All right, let's hop into today's topic. I was about to go there. You read my mind. So, like, to the future of financial professional that doesn't have the perspective that we have, because we know the answer to this, but we'll unpack it for them. They're going to be like, so what do I need to, like, why would I be going into this industry? How am I going to make money if people don't need the information that I have?
Well, people definitely need the information, because here's the thing. If I'm a doctor, I'm in the business of being a doctor. If I'm a dentist, I'm in the business of being a dentist. If I'm a lawyer, that's my business. I don't have the time to really stay abreast of everything that's going on in the industry, all the things that are changing.
If you enjoy that, you're really going to enjoy this Conversations in Finance. Hey there, my name is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube. And my guest this week is Gary Clement, who is an advocate of financial services. He's an educator. He's a practitioner. He does so many different things. We start with his money story, which actually began in the Wirehouse channel, of all places to cut their teeth, for a person to cut their teeth. And he has a very, very interesting perspective based on that, because he was investing his own money before he actually became a financial advisor, even as a career changer. But let me let Gary tell his own story.
No worries. Yeah. You know, my money story goes back years and years and years. You know, being in a family where the messages were not always positive about money. You know, I can still hear my father saying money doesn't grow on trees. I can still remember not having any money, and any money that I did have being really, really serious about using it responsibly. And this is on through middle school, high school, college. Those types of things had a profound experience on me, and influence on me. Yeah. To tell you the truth, you know, the other thing that really resonates for me is that, you know, I always wanted to be in a position to not just make money, but help people understand how they could make money and really use money as a tool to make your life better.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a professional standpoint, I wanted to be in the industry for a long period of time. I started out in the IT world. So I worked for IBM at first as a system engineer.
So you were the consummate career changer.
Yes. Yes. So I was in IT for some time and never really felt like that was a real fit.
Okay.
And I always wanted to be in, at the time, investment management.
Okay.
That's all I knew. You know, you went to one of these big brokerage firms, you got a job, you were a broker. It seemed like it was cool.
Yeah.
All those types of things. And you could learn about how to invest and how to move forward financially. Well, you know, when I had to at least gumption to begin to do that, I started studying for the Series 7 even before I had a job. I just said, okay, I want to learn this. I want to do this. I also became an individual self-directed investor at the same time.
So give me what time frame of what year or about we're talking about here. What
we're talking
years?
About the late 80s, early
90s. Okay, so this is still not even really, I mean, the industry is only about 50 years old, so this is still pretty early, relatively. So,
So, you know, I really was putting a lot of time in learning how to be an investor myself. I'd gotten my first account. You know, I was doing what I thought was right, investing, saving on a regular basis to invest, all of those things. And at the same time, I was running around interviewing and getting disrespected on a regular basis.
Yeah.
I interviewed with all of the big names and, you know, I put my best foot forward and it was always a no. I just so happened to have seen an ad for a discount brokerage firm. And at the time they were growing very rapidly and I felt like they'd be willing to take anybody with a pulse.
Okay.
And the firm I'm talking about is E-Trade. So I went, got hired. You know, my whole perspective was, let me go ahead and get this job, take this opportunity to get fully licensed, and then see about going to a full service firm. And that's exactly what I did. So I went with E-Trade. I got my Series 7. I got my Series 63. And shortly thereafter, I was recruited away to a large wirehouse firm, Morgan Stanley. So I was with Morgan Stanley for a little while. And this was around 2001. So okay. You know what happened then.
Dot com,
and then also 9/11. In fact, yeah. When I was standing with Morgan Stanley, I was in Building 2 of the World Trade Center up until the Friday before the Tuesday that the planes hit. So,
oh wow, okay,
that was quite an experience. But one of the things I'll say about Morgan Stanley is I learned a whole lot there.
Yeah,
it was a difficult time to be new in the business and be in production, but it was a really valuable time because some of the blinders that I had prior to getting that experience were taken away. So the Morgan Stanley experience was great. You know, one of the things that's a dirty secret in the business, especially if you're going to a full service firm, most people don't make it. Mm. And I was one of those people who was bounced out after a relatively short period of time. I was there for about 2 years. And then, you know, I bounced around and went to a couple of smaller firms. And then it dawned on me that I could do this on my own. And I started to research that and pursue it. And then ultimately, I started an RIA firm, which is what I run right now.
Okay. Next, I asked Gary, what were some of the most shocking developments he's seen or phenomenon he's seen in his tenure in this industry? And we talked about everything from the shrinkage of the wirehouse to methods of finding new clients to what people are actually demanding, what consumers of financial services are demanding now from us practitioners. This is what Gary had to say.
Well, what's recently surprised me the most is Schwab's purchase of TD Ameritrade.
Okay. And
now Goldman Sachs's purchase of E-Trade.
Yeah.
I think it was Goldman Sachs that bought E-Trade.
Well, I know they did United Capital. I haven't heard about the latest one, but you bring up a point of this consolidation, so which is where I think you're going with this and maybe the implications for the industry. What are your opinions?
The implications are, and Schwab has already announced this, that we're going to zero commissions, $0 mm-hmm. commissions. So yep. That has taken away the traditional means that registered reps were paid in the industry based on commissions.
Yeah.
That's really been the most shocking thing to me. And I think that's going to further fuel the move away from FINRA member firms, particularly wirehouses, and to smaller RIA-based firms. So these are the types of things that have been shocking. But the industry has been going through pretty consistent and steady change over the years. You know, back in the early 90s, you know, we were still approaching dealing with clients and prospecting the way it was done in the 80s.
This is true.
You know, cold calling for clients or doing seminars or doing...
knocking on doors. Yeah.
Knocking on doors. All of which, you know, at the time I was saying, this stuff doesn't work, you know, and especially cold calling, because when we think about cold calling now, it's not like everybody's not doing this, or let me rephrase that differently. Everybody's cold calling.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You really are not special, especially if you want to portray yourself as someone who is good in the business, great in the business, and has something to offer. In fact, you come off sounding like everybody else that's cold calling. Because now we got robo cold calls.
Yeah,
so
cold
calls don't work. People tune that out. Plus, they can stop you if they know your phone number. They can, doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so that really was difficult at the time, but now it's even more pronounced in that, you know, that's just not the way to go about getting clients. So that's one thing that I've seen starting to change. But the other thing that I've seen starting to change is that we are in a knowledge-based business. So the emphasis now is on getting more and more knowledge. And we're getting away from these large companies. So the emphasis is more on the relationship between the client and the planner than it was before. Back in the 90s, it was, hey, I got this bond offering. Does it sound good? Boom, that's it.
Yeah. I would say, you know, I left a firm, a fairly large RIA here in Dallas, And I'll say we were doing just that from 2010 to 2016, actually, you know, where, you know, granted, the demographic we were serving were mostly retirees. Mm-hmm. So they were looking, you know, in that, I would call it, let's call it the baby boomer generation. They are pretty much looking for you to give them the information. Like, you are the source and you give them the information. And I think, you know, maybe to what you're alluding to your point, like, we're changing. Gen X, which I am, you know, Gen Y and Z, they're very much like, do it yourself. I can get access to the information. What value are you bringing to me? Because it's not just the data, right? Would you agree?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the other change. The change is the availability of information. You know, certainly in the 70s and 80s, we as professionals had stranglehold on the information. Not anymore. The internet has changed that. Now you've got direct ability as a client to go to a broker and do all your trades yourself, do all your research for yourself, do all of those things. So the question is, why do I need an advisor?
And for you aspiring financial advisors, I wanted Gary to give his opinion on what the real work or the real job of a financial advisor is. And this is what he had to say. Which is the reason why you want to bring in a professional, a provider of financial services, a practitioner to help you put that barrier, that buffer in between you and your money, especially when it comes to choices that you may make that help you, that hurt you rather.
I'd agree with that 100%. And that gets back to the value that we bring as financial advisors for somebody coming into the business. Look, we stand in that space between the client and their money and the client and their goals and objectives. Mm-hmm. And we stand as the voice of reason. We also stand as that person, again, who's going to motivate that person to do the right things or not do the wrong things.
Yeah.
And help them get to their goals and objectives.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a key statement, not do the wrong things. So now, as both a practitioner and an instructor, Gary has some very unique perspective. I was curious as to what the aspiring financial professional or the future of this industry is actually thinking and experiencing as they learn about this industry. And his perspective was pretty interesting.
Well, you know, I see a lot of different students because I'm out of a lot of different places.
Yeah, yeah.
College for Financial Planning is where I'm teaching master's level classes. Kaplan, which is where I've been teaching CFP certification classes for the last 8 years. And then I've taught as part of my graduate studies at University of Georgia undergrads, as well as with Clark Atlanta University. So I see students that run the gamut.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'd say about the younger students is, you know, they really don't know what they're getting into.
Okay.
I say that in as positive way as possible. You know, a lot of people get into the business because they want to help people. And that's what most of us have gotten in the business for.
Yeah.
But they don't understand that it's a business as well. So they're always wondering about, well, how do I get into the business and do plans and help a client? And there's not that many jobs that allow somebody coming out of college to
We're getting to that whole elephant in the room about, I don't want to sell. I don't want to.
That's exactly it. So a lot of them are very concerned about having to go into production.
Yeah.
Those are still the predominant jobs that are out there, you know, whether they're insurance based or whether they're at a bank channel or whether they're with.
Well, let's unpack that because I would say that, you know, I'm not a natural. And when people say a natural salesperson, you know, you kind of think about that, you know, social butterfly, very garrulous, you know, all these types of things that they can work a room. But then to the more introverted persons or the more, introspective, they're like, there's no way I could do that. But would you agree that being able to sell, offer a product or service to someone is a learned skill? Absolutely. You can learn it just like you tie your shoes or anything else.
Absolutely. I now don't believe that there is the born salesperson.
Okay.
I think more people are more like what you described yourself as, and I'm the same way. You know, I wouldn't consider myself to be, you know, somebody who could sell anything to anybody. You know, but it does take a certain amount of learning what it takes to sell. It does take a measure of confidence, and it does take a super thick skin because you're going to get no most of the time. You know, yeah. And I think that's what scares people mostly.
Yeah, rejection. I would agree.
Rejection. You know, yep. But the rejection's okay. You know, once you feel good about getting no, then nothing else can really stop you.
This is true.
And that's really what it comes down to. If you can feel good about that, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Because the bottom line is, how many yeses do you really need?
We also cover what he feels is the number one piece of advice and what I feel Jumpstart is all about is getting experience. And he kind of goes over what he feels is the best way to do that. Take a look.
That's an incredibly hard bill to learn this industry and start a business at the same time. You probably want to do one first and then the other later.
Let me underscore that.
Yeah.
Did not pick that up. Let me underscore that.
Yeah.
I get this question all the time. I know students want to go out on their own, even if they've had a little bit of experience and they're worried about, you know, that first job and what that job should or could be. You know, they come to me, they ask me what I think about it. And my stock answer is, it doesn't matter.
If I agree. You
can get a job with an insurance company and you're comfortable with that, take it. If you can get a job with a bank, take it. If you can get a job with a wirehouse, take it. If you can get a job with one of these bigger conglomerates that you're sitting there answering the phone, take it. The reason I say that is you got to get experience. And if you have no experience, you have nothing to compare anything against.
Yeah.
So you want to get experience. And you want to get experience on somebody else's dime.
Say it, man. Say it. I was going to bring it up.
Exactly. You want to get experience on somebody else's dime. And then you can take that experience to your own practice if you want to make that move.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I've thrown out into my Facebook group a couple times, you know, one great way for you to get experience is, like you mentioned earlier, volunteering. And there are so many teachers in school districts that would love for somebody to come in and talk about financial education, financial literacy on a career day. And you can really practice on, you know, elementary kids with your level of communication. Because if they don't understand, then you probably need to break it down a little bit further. So there's so many different ways that you can do it. Now, all of them are not going to be paying you dollars, which is, I think, is the okay. problem. But yes, exactly. It's okay. It's a means to an end, right?
Absolutely. I told students not long ago, it was a panel discussion here at University of Georgia, and a similar question was asked. And one of the things I said is, after teaching this stuff for 15, 16 years, I think that one of the things you should do is look at this from the standpoint of an educator. And while you may not get a job, there's places you can go to teach folks. You can volunteer at your church. You can volunteer at some other group. Your students, you can volunteer by teaching your peers. There's a lot of different things you can do. And one of the things that's important about that is it's synergistic. So as you get better teaching somebody something around the business, you get better advising your clients.
Yep.
So that fuels your knowledge and experience to help clients. And at the same time, when you're dealing with clients, you got more information that'll help you educate people who are coming along in business. So there's plenty of opportunities. You can do it for free. You can do it at the library. You can put up a flyer somewhere. People will come. Yeah. You can even do it on Zoom if you got enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can do it online. Thanks for taking the time with me today to listen. Just one quick question before we continue. Have you subscribed to my YouTube channel yet? If you haven't, I want to give you just one more reason to subscribe. Each week, I'm going to be sharing what I've learned in 20 plus years in the industry so that you can reach your goals faster. How's that? Now back to this week's episode.
Next, Gary and I talked about some different routes into the industry. And listen to what he says about what career changers should do when it comes to tackling their CFP coursework or going after the designation.
Give me your opinion on this particular track. On career changer, I've been in some industry 5, 10, 15, whatever years. And then I go, I want to be a financial advisor. However that thought came into your mind. And then you immediately go whole head hog into the education requirement for CFP, CHFC, whatever, you know, whatever suits your fancy, before you start to try to get experience. What would you say to that particular track?
Well, you know, I think that's going to be real difficult. And the reason I say that is because your experience helps you get through a lot of the licensing and a lot of the designations that you could take on. And is there's no substitute for the experience as well. So you can have a CFP, you can have a CHFC, you can have a CFA, and still not be able to function effectively with clients, or function effectively putting together a plan, or function effectively putting together an investment plan for someone. So experience is really, really important. How people get it, there's a lot of different ways. Certainly they can get a job, they can volunteer, they can do a lot of things to get the experience. So while one shouldn't be in front of the other, and if there is one way to put one in front of the other, it should be the experience first. If you're going to go that route, you should find ways to get experience while you're taking on education.
It's not cheap. I mean, you're going to pretty much be out of 18 months of studying for the coursework, and hopefully you passed the exam on the first time, and you're going to be about $10,000 lighter.
Yeah, no question. No question. And the thing is, it's still getting back to experience, and you can manufacture that yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that people, you know, jumping into the business should really take stock of, because, you know, they're not going to be able to function well without experience, because it's going to be quite clear that you don't really have a handle on all the things that could happen if you've never been through it.
Speaking of the CFP designation, next, Gary and I dove into the importance of the designation and what it means in the industry and how a financial professional can leverage it when it comes to their career.
Yeah, certified financial planning designation is really, I think, the best one to go for if that's going to be your only designation, or if you want to get a broad scope of knowledge. I'm you can call me the Pied Piper for CFP land, because I've been teaching it so long.
Yeah.
One of the things that I valued after going through the process was, once again, even after being at Morgan Stanley, being at a lot of different places and having experience, my experience was limited to the investment world. And I think that many of us come into the business from a specific perspective. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the investment world, you come from that perspective. You're in the insurance world, you come from the insurance perspective. You're in the accounting world, you come from that perspective. And it does give you a lot of blinders with regards to how to accomplish things for clients.
That's
one
a good point.
Things that the CFP does is it gives you a whole huge breadth of knowledge. So now you can begin to see that there's a lot of different ways that you can accomplish things. Without that knowledge, if you're an insurance guy, you're like a carpenter who just has a hammer. Every problem looks like a nail.
No, I agree. Would you kind of connotate that being kind of like, I've referred to the CFP mile wide, inch deep, where you're going to go over estate, you're going to go over taxes, you're going to go over retirement, you're going to go over insurance, you're going to go, you know, you're going to go over, you're going to hit all of that stuff. But if you want to go super deep, you probably want to go to a specialist grad degree or maybe another designation. The CFP is not to take you all the way down the rabbit hole. Would you agree?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. But it gives you enough so that you're conversing in all of those areas. Now, again, you may not be an expert in all those areas, but you can have high level conversations and you can find somebody who can shore up areas where you don't have the requisite competence and have conversations with them and even be able to interpret conversations that they have with the clients. So that's a really important designation. It's hard to get. So we can't underestimate these.
It's not easy.
It's definitely not easy. And you're right. You're talking about 18 months of your time.
Yeah.
And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is it's not just 18 months, but it's 18 months during which you're going to have to cut a lot of stuff off, a lot of people off. You're going to have to negotiate with those important people in your life, because this is about dedication. You're going to need to study more than you probably ever studied in your life. The test is probably more difficult than you've taken or had a test in your life.
Yeah.
This is the kind of animal it is. It's not easy to pass. But the great thing is, you know, with the CFP, you're really in the best place you could be if you're really taking this industry seriously. Because at the baseline, you're going to get a really good education around financial services and what can be done for clients. Yep. If that only helps you as an individual, that's going to be important.
Yeah.
But, you know, taking the test and passing the test means now you're stamped as an expert in the field. Now you're going to be able to go forth and help clients more efficiently, Hopefully that's going to help clients get comfortable with the information that you're giving them. That education is going to go on to the client's family and friends, and the impact that you can have is far greater.
Yeah.
One of the things that I try to emphasize with folks who are beginning to study for the exam, that's motivation really doesn't do the trick. Everybody's motivated initially.
Yeah.
Motivation wanes over time. You really have to focus on being committed and being able to discipline yourself over a long period of time. So yeah. It's about perspiration and not inspiration. And you got to work consistently over a very long period of time. And the other folks, you know, say, okay, I know I can't do this all the time. And I say, look, nobody can do that all the time. But you got to have that mindset. And the other thing is, look, I know that sometimes studying is going to be hard. Other things are going to seem more attractive in terms of what you want to spend time on. But I assert this. I assert that those times when studying is getting hard, that students are looking at it as an obligation and not an opportunity.
Mm.
And when you turn it around and look at it as an opportunity, then it will make those times when it's hard to study a little bit easier. And what's the opportunity? The opportunity is to have the CFP designation, which is probably the gold standard in financial planning. And certainly it's the designation that most people know about. But beyond that, you're stamped as an expert in the field. You have the opportunity to help people. You have the opportunity to help yourself. This is a noble profession. Where else can you go to do good things for other people and also do well for yourself? So these are all those things that are the opportunities around passing the CFP exam and why you should look at it as an opportunity instead of an obligation during those times when the Masked Singer might look like more fun for that evening.
Also, since Gary has such a great wealth of knowledge, I wanted him to give context on, you know, the past, present, and future. What is the industry getting right? What are we doing wrong? And this is what he had to say.
I think that, you know, we're going away from the transaction-oriented broker who really may or may not have a relationship with the client. And it's all about, can I get these folks to trade? And sometimes, you know, that's not their objective, but you always have to have that in the back of your mind as a client. You know, whether in fact, you know, this conflict of interest that exists is behind the advice that I'm getting.
Yeah.
We're getting away from that, and we are getting more towards a relationship-based business. And that's so important. But one of the other things that we're getting to is we're getting to see that even with the bigger firms, that they're taking a different approach, even with the new people that are coming on. Rather than putting them in the bullpen and making them call, you know, many firms are putting them on teams. So they have an opportunity to grow in the business while
or advisor development programs too. Yeah, that's a good point.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, this is really shifting the business away from that transaction oriented model. Along with that, technology.
Yeah.
Look, 20 years ago, there was a lot that you could do at a wirehouse that individuals couldn't reproduce. But now all of the tools are available. It's going to cost you a little bit, but you can have just as efficient and effective technology as the big wirehouses have. So the playing field
is
leveled between smaller advisors and bigger advisors.
I've talked to many practitioners that are in this field that have an opinion about where this industry is headed as far as what the top skills are and what the top discipline will be in the future for financial services. And this is what Gary had to say.
The other thing that I think the business is getting right, slowly but surely, and I think it's going to really begin to pick up a lot of steam as we make it really clear that this is a relationship business, is behavioral finance. And you know I'm big on that since I'm
teaching
that. I've become more and more convinced that that is the really future of this business, because again, we can set things up for people. We can set up a plan for them, but if we can't motivate them to take action, then nothing's going to happen. Yeah. But the other thing that we got to understand is we come from a business that trains us to suggest that people are rational and people make decisions logically. Now, we know from experience that people are not rational.
Especially when it comes to their money.
Exactly. And many times they don't make decisions logically. But one of the things that behavioral finance teaches us is that not only are people irrational and prone to make, you know, bad decisions, but they do so in sometimes very predictable ways. So if we can learn the ways that people are making poor decisions, let's not say poor decisions, let's say suboptimal decisions.
Yeah.
If we can learn the ways that people are effectively making suboptimal decisions in predictable ways, then we can help them begin to think differently.
Yeah.
And make better decisions. And the other thing is, you know, people come to you with money scripts, and money scripts are things that they've learned in the past that have some partial truths to them, but are not really effective for where they are in the future. And these are things that are going on in the background. If we can help people identify them and become aware of them, now we got some control over those scripts and can begin to develop new scripts. So some people have scripts like rich people are evil. Well, if that's your script, then how is it going to be for you if you're trying to gain riches?
Yeah. You're going to sabotage. You're going to self-sabotage.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and these things can also develop into disorders as well. So hoarding is a disorder. It's similar. Gambling is a disorder. Compulsive buying, disorder. You know, so these are the types of things that if we can help clients gain a foothold in terms of understanding and changing those things, I think that's where, you know, a tremendous value to being an advisor is for a client. And I think that we're moving in that direction. Those things are becoming far more emphasized by the board as well. And one of the things that you find on the exam, years ago when I went through, and probably went still when you went through as well, the board, not only the education, but the exam was geared towards technical answers.
Yes.
Now the exam is geared towards more of the softer side of financial planning. So ethics is more important.
Mm-hmm.
Regulatory requirements more important. The economy more important. Those things that you should or shouldn't be doing vis-a-vis clients more important. So the softer side is becoming far more emphasized than the technical answers. They're still there.
Yeah.
But they're not the predominant type of question. This is another reason why behavioral finance is important as well. Look, we got robo-advisors. We have the internet. We have algorithms that can put together all of the things that we used to put together and have made them commodities.
Yeah.
Well, what's not going to be replaced is human interaction. And that is where a lot of the value that we can still bring to clients. And moving forward, that's where it's going to be. So it behooves somebody to get really comfortable with behavioral finance, even those folks that are thinking about getting a degree in order to take this on.
Now, if you're wondering about skills for the next generation advisor, make sure you write all of these down.
EQ is an important thing because it gets around the idea that we talked about in terms of selling and getting comfortable with no. You know, if you can traverse those two things and do well with it, you're going to be fine in business.
Yeah.
The bottom line is we've got to translate our knowledge in a way that clients will understand it. At the same time, we've got to meet our clients emotionally where they are and help them help themselves, knowing that there may be some foibles that'll stop them from getting to where they really want to go. But that's okay. Yeah. That's going to be where the business is going. Financial therapy is definitely important.
Yeah.
Because people are definitely going to be impacted by all the stuff that happens in their life. Yeah. And it's going to come out in their lives in all of the areas of people activity, including money. So we've really got to really get a handle on that. And when we think about that, we got to also acknowledge that some of the messages that people get about money and some of the ways that it begins to be acted out in their lives is not only their own decisions about money. A lot of it is intergenerational.
Yeah.
So
no, you're right.
If a parent thought a specific way about money,
they passed that on.
They passed that on, and it was passed on by their parents. You know, so these are the types of things that we really have to get a handle on, because without getting a handle on it, like you said, people will self-sabotage and not meet their goals and objectives. And it has nothing to do with the plan that we put together, which could get them there. It has nothing to do with the investments that we put together for them, which could get them there. You know, there's nothing to stop them from going around you and calling up the broker and saying, "Look, sell all of this stuff. I don't care what my advisor
or say. Or making that big ticket purchase that you talk to them about not doing. Yeah,
exactly. And there's another thing too, and that is, if we're going to meet clients where they are using techniques and using our ability to parse what they've said against our knowledge of behavioral finance, then we probably should do that kind of work ourselves.
Good point.
And that's another thing that, you know, people might find daunting.
Yeah.
Would you go to a doctor who never experienced certain things?
Yeah.
would you go to a therapist who never got married and they're talking to you about marriage counseling?
Yeah, you're right.
So we've got to really think about how to experience this and then bring our experience along with our knowledge to help clients.
Requirements. I always advocate get comfortable with video. Like you can, mm-hmm. you can portray so much of a message that's not lost in translation through all these different other mediums like writing and things of that nature. But through video, you can tell stories and things of that nature. I say get real comfortable with it because that's where we're going.
Oh, no
question. We're not already there. Yeah.
You know, if we can go back to a question that you asked earlier about where the business is going like right here where we are.
In our lightning round, I wanted to ask Gary, what is he telling his clients currently about the coronavirus and three skills that a person should develop before they enter into the industry? And what does he feel his legacy would be?
This is a once in a generation type of event. We're really looking at something that's very similar to 1929, 1987, 2000, and 2008. But it's so bad, it's really close to 1929. So this is not something that we could have really anticipated coming this quickly. We're talking about the last week and a half.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the S&P 500 has dropped over 100 points. You know, so this is not something that you could really guard against. So the major word here is you got to plan, be patient. The market always comes back. And this is not the time to worry. And this is not the time to panic. Become a good educator.
Mm.
Become a good communicator and be a student of human behavior.
Mm. Like that.
I say that because, you know, if we can't communicate some of these really complex ideas in a way that clients can understand, then it's not going to matter. You know, if we don't take the humble approach of an educator who is going to do what it takes to make sure that people understand what we're saying, then again, it's not going to matter. And getting back to behavioral finance, if we don't understand human behavior, then nothing we tell clients is going to matter. You know, my legacy, I think, will be in helping people in this business from the standpoint of an advisor for clients, but mostly as a mentor for students. I think that the kind of impact that I can have by helping people get into the business the right way, help clients, help those clients, help their families, can be an impact that I can't even fathom at this time. So, you know, that's why I'm a Pied Piper for the CFP world, because I think with the education that advisors are more positioned or better positioned to really, really be of tremendous value to clients. And I really get excited about helping students because, again, most of us get into this business for the right reasons, and that's to help people.
Yeah.
And there isn't much more of a noble profession than this, where you can do great things for people and do well for yourself. But the bottom line is you're doing great things for people. And
yeah,
we need that. We need that more now than ever. And,
yeah,
and a lot of this gets back to, you know, our conversation has looped in and out and back and forward, but it gets back to, you know, being able to help people get over the things that are stopping themselves get to where they really want to go. Because
yeah,
anybody can do it. It's a matter of getting out of your own way and helping people do that, I think, is where my legacy would be.
Well, that wraps up this week's episode, and I hope you were able to glean at least one takeaway that will help you on your path. You know what? I'd really love to hear what it was that I said that may have helped you. Feel free to drop me an email at info@djh-capital.com. That's info@djh-capital.com. One last thing, my friend.
it would really help the podcast if you would leave a review on the platform that you're enjoying it on. I'd really appreciate it, and it will help more financial professionals like yourself find out about what we're doing here. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.